You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Abigail Adams was so involved in the political affairs of her day that the press dubbed her Mrs. President. Still, that's a long way from nowadays when a woman who was once First Lady is actually running for president. In her latest book, Ladies of Liberty, The Women Who Shaped Our Nation, Cokie Roberts explores the political worlds of the women behind the men who led this country in its past. It's published by William Morrow, an imprint of HarperCollins, and it is my great pleasure to welcome NPR and ABC correspondent Cokie Roberts back to the show.
It's so nice to be here. Thank you.
In one of your previous books, Founding Mothers, you examine the lives of women who helped to shape America. Are they different women than the ones you've included here?
Only because that was the beginning of the period. What I wanted to write about was the founding period, because I deal with it so much in covering Congress and politics. I mean, think how often people invoke these founding fathers. It's really remarkable. And so I got very curious about the women, and so I started. My intention initially was to write a book that went from the period before the Revolution through the election of John Quincy Adams, which is literally the next generation. And it was just getting to be way too big a book. So I stopped it at the election of John Adams, which is the first contested election under the new Constitution. And then wrote what turned out to be the second half, so that goes from Adams to Adams. So some of the women are the same, and then there are a bunch of new women.
And some of the territory covered here is before John Adams became president, because you have to explain and bring us up to date. I assume that another inspiration was your own personal experience. Your father was a congressman, and your mother was the wife of a congressman, and then she took over the seat after he died. It must have gotten you thinking on some level about the women behind the scenes who might have been as effective as their husbands if they'd been given the opportunity.
Absolutely. You know, my father was first elected to Congress in 1940 at the age of 26. And every time I think about this, you know, from this great distance, my mother was this 24-year-old, had two little children, neither of whom was me, and came up to Washington. It's pre-war. And it was still people calling, you know, you called on the cabinet one day, the Supreme Court one day, the Senate one day, the House one day, and received the next. And the first people to collect her to go calling, come honk the horn, were Pauline Gore and Lady Bird Johnson. So I grew up watching those women, and in both parties, Betty Ford, these just remarkable women run everything. They ran their husbands' offices. They ran their campaigns. They, when their husbands went into the leadership, they often ran the district office. They, of course, ran all of us kids.
And they had all the entertainment.
They had all the entertainment where the deals were made at the parties. And they did various things for their parties. They did voter registration drives and helped put on the conventions and all of those things. So I knew how influential those women were. And I figured in this unique and crucial period of our history, they had to be at least as influential.
Do you think things were the same, and have they remained the same?
I think those women were, if anything, even more influential because it was such a difficult time, and the men needed them so much that they relied on them to run the household, by which I mean support the family at various times. But they also relied on them for their judgment. And so I think that these women were in some ways even more involved in political than in modern times, which sounds ridiculous because, of course, they couldn't vote. They couldn't own property if they were married. They couldn't even own the jewelry on their own bodies. But they were running things quite definitely.
Well, this is at a time when women, as you say, had no real rights, and most women probably had no say. So are we really talking about exceptional women who come to this situation through exceptional circumstances?
Yes, mainly. We're talking about elite women for the most part.
From the upper classes.
Yes, because that's who... I mean, because what I'm talking about is the women who influenced the men who wrote the documents and ran the government. So that's who you are talking about. But it is also true that there were movements taking place, and you would see women come from a variety of backgrounds in and form and shape those movements, and then those then, in the same way that they do today, had an effect on the government in Washington.
There were certain areas women could go into, education, for example.
Well, even that was, I mean, now that we think about that from yours and my childhood, women were in education, of course.
All of my teachers in elementary school.
Well, mine were nuns, and that was really good women teachers. But the at that time, even education wasn't all that open to women, and what started to happen as a result of the revolution was a movement to educate women because this new baby republic needed virtuous citizens, and that would require mothers to raise them, and that meant education for women.
So the women really had to be educated so that their sons ultimately would be educated. Is that why Aaron Burr hounded his daughter to study Greek and practice Latin?
No, I think Aaron Burr actually wanted his daughter to be equal to a man.
He was an early feminist.
He traveled with Mary Wollstonecraft, the writer of The Vindication of the Rights of Women. He traveled with her portrait until his death. So he truly believed in women's rights, and he felt strongly that she had as good a mind as any man, which she clearly did. And so in his case, it was educating her to be educated. And at one point, the night before he fought Alexander Hamilton in the duel, he wrote to his son-in-law and said, protect her mind, make sure she continues to learn. I mean, that was the thing he was most concerned about.
But then what could she do with it?
Well, she could be an educated and interesting person, and he thought that she could also rule a nation. He had schemes of grandeur of conquering Mexico and putting her on the throne. But I think that the idea was that women could be useful to the nation, not only as mothers, but as wives, sisters, friends, if they were educated and had good judgment.
My guest is Cokie Roberts, in case you don't recognize her voice. Her latest book is called Ladies of Liberty, The Women Who Shaped Our Nation, and it is published by, what did I say, HarperCollins?
William Morrow.
It's also conglomeratized. Morrow, HarperCollins / whatever else. Do you think that it was different for the girls if their mothers were alive or if their fathers were widowers? For example, I'm thinking of Thomas Jefferson,
right,
who his eldest daughter had a really weird relationship with him.
She did. I'm delighted you're focusing on these daughters, because it's one of the things that I found very interesting was this relationship of fathers and daughters. And
we'll get to the wives.
But they did seem to vest a certain amount of power in their daughters. And Thomas Jefferson's wife died as a result of childbirth when his oldest daughter was 10. And then there was a four-year-old and the newborn, and the newborn died soon. And he took the four-year-old went off to live with an aunt, and Martha, called Patsy, went to live with him. And yes, he instructed her in all kinds of things, and similarly to Burr. And he was, I think, somewhat hard on her in terms of the things he expected of her. But he also depended on her mightily as an emotional support.
She was almost a surrogate wife,
right,
to the point where he expected her to neglect her own family,
right,
to give him that support.
And she did, at least her husband. She had a baby every year, and she raised them. She wrote to him at one point that her devotion to him had been complete all of her life, and nothing that had transpired had changed the fact that he was first in her affection. And that was after she was married and had several children.
The more I read about Thomas Jefferson, the more
complicated he is.
Right. I mean, he still did some great things, but between Sally Hemings and the slaves and what the way he treated his daughter.
He's a very complicated man. But there are places in here where he's delightful. He was darling to his grandchildren. And he wrote them letters all the time that are dear and sent them presents. And when he and Adams finally renewed their correspondence later in life, they got into sort of a grandchild competition, which is just endearing.
You begin the book with the death of George Washington, and it's interesting that Abigail Adams led the mourning. I mean, her husband was the vice president. Was he?
Well, at the time of the death, he was president.
He was president. He had been George Washington's vice president. Why did she wind up with that chore?
She was good at it. And she took it over.
Was Laura Linney, did she look like Laura Linney?
She was quite pretty. By the time she was First Lady, she was older. But she, the pictures of her as a young woman are very attractive. And she apparently, and this does not come as a surprise, I think, had very lively eyes. And of course, her intellect was so great that I'm sure that her face was enlivened by that. But she understood that George Washington was a figure like no other, even though that irritated her because she felt that her husband was just as good. But Adams was going into a rough political campaign against Jefferson, and to the degree that she could associate him firmly with Washington, the better she thought it would be for him. So she made a point of soaking those funeral orations and processions and memorials for everything they were worth, hoping they'd be politically helpful to her husband.
Now, she and all of these other wives had endured the moves of the Capitol, New York, Philadelphia, Boston. And I'm sure that had made things more difficult. And then they wound up in the new Washington, D.C., which was a really awful place to be at the time.
Washington,
she was the first First Lady in Washington, D.C.?
She was the first First Lady, and she wasn't there terribly long, but she arrived there, and she's very funny about it, about how, you know, they're just vast expanses with nothing, and it's muddy, and it's a construction site. And she gets to what we call the White House now, and it's this great barn of a house that takes 13 fires to warm it, and it's expensive, and it's not finished at all. And she famously hangs the laundry in the East Room, which is where we now see presidential press conferences. But Washington, the city, serves as kind of a theme through this book. I didn't really expect that to happen, but the letters, and I should talk for a second about that. I mean, finding these letters is just such a treat and detective.
Where did you find them?
In historic societies and historic homes and universities. But people, now that it was a second book and they had seen the first, people were much more helpful about producing them. But many of them have never been published. But as I would read these letters, Washington kept coming up because the first people to get there were just overwhelmed by how terrible it was. And then they start to get used to it and say, well, you know, it's getting better and we've got a theater now and the races are great and a circus has come to town. And then somebody new will come to town and say, what is this place? There's nothing here.
But were the First Ladies expected to create some kind of society life there?
Absolutely. There was nothing else to do. And members of the cabinet and to some degree congressional wives were coming to town. And so there had to be some kind of social life, and the First Ladies would be the people to do it.
My guest is Cokie Roberts, the political commentator for ABC News and senior news analyst for National Public Radio, and author of a number of books, including the bestseller Founding Mothers, and now a follow-up, Ladies of Liberty, The Women Who Shaped Our Nation, published by William Morrow. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Cokie Roberts, who's now I can say it. Her latest book,
right,
is Ladies of Liberty, The Women Who Shaped Our Nation, published by William Morrow. And we mentioned earlier that Thomas Jefferson was a widower, and he often enlisted his eldest daughter to serve as the first lady of sorts. But sometimes she was not the right person. And
well, she wasn't there much. She lived in Virginia and was mostly at Monticello or her own place. And she had a lot of children. But so she only really came to Washington for two stays. But Dolly Madison served really as the unofficial hostess more than anyone else in Thomas Jefferson's administration.
So she would handle a state dinner like the one when the British envoy Anthony Mary and his wife Elizabeth came to the White House.
Yes, and that this is a again, when I say Thomas Jefferson is complicated, this is a perfect example. Now, look, he lost no love for the British. He wrote the Declaration of Independence, after all, and it is full of attacks, you know, of the British atrocities. And then when he was presented in the court of St. James, King George turned his back on him. So, yeah, all right.
It was considered an insult that he'd been sent there.
Well, he was in Paris, and Adams brought him and introduced him. I understand all that, but still, he was president. This was a country where we had to have diplomatic relations. And Elizabeth Mary and Anthony Mary came to town, and this is midway through his first term. And he, instead of escorting first he greets, when Mary comes to present his credentials, Jefferson greets him in bedroom slippers and all disheveled. And then he has what's supposed to be a welcoming dinner for them. They are the guest of honor. And the first thing that happens when they walk in is they see the French minister there, and the two countries are at war. And then when it comes time to move from the drawing room to the dining room, instead of escorting Elizabeth Mary, the guest of honor, the president takes the arm of Dolly Madison. And Dolly says to him, "Take Mrs. Mary." And he ignores her and marches on in. And it became an international incident. And Mary didn't know whether some signal was being sent to his government. And Jefferson kept it up. And it was just a mess, and it was so unnecessary. It was the kind of sort of stupid thing to do, that just to stick your finger in the eye of someone that causes problems that you don't need. But in fact, Mary's secretary, who later did become ambassador, thought it was the cause of the War of 1812. I think that's an overstatement.
But Dolly Madison has come to represent the ideal first lady, partly because of her cooking, and you recently baked a cake from a Dolly Madison recipe with Martha Stewart.
I did. It was great.
Where did you find that recipe?
I found it in a wonderful cookbook that Poppy Cannon, who was a famous cookbook writer in the 1950s and 60s, put together with a photographer, and it's called The President's Cookbook, I think, and let me find the citation, but and she has recipes from Martha Washington on, but Dolly Madison's, we do not have her recipes written in her hand anywhere. We do have some of the others written down, and there's a place where she, it's called The President's Cookbook, Practical Recipes from George Washington to the Present. And it was Poppy Cannon and Patricia Brooks in 1968.
Were they eating well in the early years of the
United
States? Oh,
yes. They were eating great amounts of food to begin with. And it was hearty food. Dolly Madison was known for her entertainments. And this layer cake is apparently one of the ones that people talked about. I did find a letter from the departing French ambassador's wife to her with a P.S. written in French saying, I'm going to get you those recipes you've asked for fish salad and something else as soon as I can get them from the cook. So she was soliciting recipes to vary her cooking.
Now, you mentioned that these husbands often solicited advice from their wives. The one that came as the biggest surprise to me was John Marshall, the first our first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and his wife Polly. Now, she had to put up with him being gone for long periods of time before he went to the Supreme Court. I guess all of them, because it took so long to travel.
Yes, the absences were enormous. And, of course,
they'd be left pregnant and then alone to bear
to
the
deal
child.
With it. And Polly Ambler, Mary Ambler Marshall, was a depressive. And so she had a very hard time with it. But I thought you were referring to the wonderful letter. And this is the thing that's so delightful about learning history through the eyes of the women instead of the men, which is that not only do you meet all these fascinating women, and every letter in this book, almost every, with the exception of five maybe, quotation in this book is either written by a woman, to a woman, or about a woman. Now, you don't read American history like that very often. And so you not only meet these women, but you get to know the men in a completely human way. You know, they're not just these statesmen. They are regular people. And John Marshall wrote this letter to his wife when he was riding the circuit, and he was in Raleigh, North Carolina, which was a brand new town, and says, you know, I got here without any breeches, and I thought that I could find a tailor to fix it for me quickly, but the tailors are all busy, so I shall have to spend the entire session as a sans-culotte. Now, you don't read that in the letters from John Marshall to, you know, to John Adams.
But you do get the sense that these wives had to be really competent what they did.
Oh.
They not only were consulted on all sorts of matters, but they also had to run the businesses and the farms
when
husbands were away during the war, for example. And when their husbands came back, were they expected to return to their more subservient roles?
It depended on the couple and the relationship. Abigail Adams ran everything for so long because John Adams, of course, was abroad for many years while she was running the farm and, to some degree, his legal business in Massachusetts. And after the presidency, when they retired back to Quincy, he essentially said to her, you do it. You've done it all along. You're better at it than I am. And he retired to, you know, writing vast correspondence and reading romance novels.
Romance novels, which probably were largely written by women. That was one of the areas where women were allowed to excel, although they usually didn't use their own name.
Well, they were starting to by this time. You know, you had two big bestsellers, Susanna Rowson's book, Charlotte Temple, and that was the biggest bestseller anywhere until Harriet Beecher Stowe. And then Hannah Foster's book, The Coquette. Those were under their own names.
My guess is Cokie Roberts. Her latest book is Ladies of Liberty, The Women Who Shaped Our Nation. I'm sorry if I cut you off.
No, you didn't. There were also, you know, English men writing these romance novels. Richardson.
Was Abigail a good role model for her daughter-in-law, Louisa, who became the first lady when John Quincy became president?
Well, I think Louisa and Abigail had a very hard relationship at the beginning, which came together at the end. And that happens in families. But Abigail Adams was a very domineering and impressive person. And this girl was raised in England. She had never been to America until she and John had been married for a while, John Quincy. And she was scared of Abigail, and Abigail didn't do anything to allay her fears. But she also, Louisa Adams, is interesting about the women of the Revolutionary period and how strong they were, the women who went through the war. And Abigail Adams was certainly one of those. There were times when she was physically in great danger.
Do we know her position on the Alien and Sedition Acts?
Abigail Adams?
Which got her husband in so much trouble.
Oh, yes, we do. And that I find very interesting because she was politically so savvy, as I was saying, about the Washington funeral ceremonies and all of that. And before he was president, she gave him excellent political advice. But once he became president, she fell into the trap that I think most executives have fallen into ever since, which is that they start to develop a kind of under siege mentality, and that they're the people in the government doing what's right for everyone and working so hard, and why doesn't everybody just understand that and leave them alone, or better yet, honor and respect them. And this was a time of rabid partisanship. And, of course, the press was completely irresponsible and out of control. And so she hated all of that. And she wrote at one point, here's a letter. This is quoting Abigail Adams. "I wish the laws of our country were competent to punish the stirrer up of sedition, the writer and printer of base and unfounded calumny." So she was very much lobbying for the Alien and Sedition Acts. And, of course, they are what in the end did in John Adams. So her political judgment there was terrible.
We have no idea what Laura Bush thought about the Patriot Act.
No, we don't, although we do know that there have been times that Laura Bush, like all of these women, has essentially said, give it a rest, dear.
And Nancy used to whisper to Ron every once in a while, give him advice in public, in fact. You've included Sacagawea in your group of Ladies of Liberty. Why? She was, I mean, she played a major role in the exploration of the West with Lewis and Clark, but does she really fit into this?
Yes, because, well, first of all, by the way, I don't know when this happened in our history, but she is now Sacagawea. I don't know why, but, you know, it's like Beijing and Peking or something. But
next you're going to tell me it's Pocahontas.
There you go. But, well, the movement west and the purchase of Louisiana and all of that was so key to what was going on in the government. And everybody was so interested in it. In fact, the Lewis and Clark expedition so fascinated the women of Washington that they raised money for it because they didn't think the congressional appropriation was high enough. So their success, I would argue, made a tremendous difference to the country as a whole, and they would not have succeeded without Sacagawea. And she, at various times, and they, everything I write about her is from their journals, from Lewis and Clark's journals. And they give her a lot of credit. It took them a while. They did it grudgingly. But by the end, they understood that she protected them, and she also was the liaison between them and the Shoshone Indians that allowed them to get the horses that they needed to travel west.
In looking over the letters from some of these women, was anyone making statements that we might characterize as feminist today?
Sure. Well, of course, Abigail Adams, famous Remember the Ladies, was earlier in 1775, but yes, I mean, there are all kinds of little asides. Louisa Adams says at one point, "You keep reminding me that the Constitution doesn't give me any rights, but you expect me to do all these things to get you elected." You had feminist writers. Judith Sargent Murray is in this book, and she was very strongly a proponent of women's rights. And she has a great line at one point about, you know, little boys, and does anybody think a 2-year-old boy is smarter than a 2-year-old girl? Obviously not. You know, and does anything happen along the way to change that? Education was her answer.
One of the things that I think has remained constant is the decision by some of these women to stand by their men. We have Eliza Hamilton. And it doesn't seem all that different from what we've seen recently with the wives of a president, senators, governors, and mayors in recent years.
Right. She was probably wearing pearls when she did it. But well, Alexander Hamilton was accused of succumbing to blackmail, which he in fact did. And the opposition said, oh, he had done this. He was being blackmailed for having traded illegally in government securities, and he was Secretary of the Treasury. So in order to prove that that was not the case, he had to go public with what he was being blackmailed for, which was the blackmailer was the husband of a woman with whom he had had an affair. So he had to give a confession. And he says, I say this not without a blush, but I was not unfaithful to my country, but to my wife. She not only stood by him, she saved his political life because she was a Schuyler. She was of a famous old New York Dutch family. And he was an illegitimate West Indian. And by standing by him, she absolutely saved his political life, and she hated the fact that he had confessed, and she would buy up every copy of the confession that she could find. And he and unscrupulous bookstore owners would print up extra copies just to have her buy them.
We've pretty much run out of time, but are you going to follow up on this? Is it going to
be
another volume?
No, this was the founding period, and it is now over. I have contracts to do children's books of each of these two books, and that will be the next project.
Ladies of Liberty, The Women Who Shaped Our Nation, is published by William Morrow. Thank you so much, Cokie Roberts, for being with us again.
Thank you so much for having me.